Hello and welcome to the Columbia Daily Tribune's Mizzou Sports Podcast. This is Tribune Sports Editor Joe Waljasper, along with Tribune Football Beat Writer Blake Topmeyer. We will devote the entire podcast to football this week. National Signing Day was Wednesday, and Missouri had a staff announcement on Friday, so there's plenty to talk about. Blake, to begin with the disclaimer that we have no idea what the answer to this question really is, how did Missouri maybe meet its needs with this recruiting class?
Well, I think in some ways they did, in that they got three junior college defensive tackles who on paper look pretty good, and just in terms of their resume. I mean, if you're going to go the junior college route, which I think they kind of needed to because they needed guys that could step in at that position in particular and contribute, you know, you go for the best junior college players, and they got a guy in Malik Young that was a first-team All-American. He was his conference's defensive player of the year. So was Rashad Brandon, another JUCO defensive tackle in his conference. And then they got another guy in Walter Palmore. So to me, defensive tackle was the biggest need that they had needed to be addressed, with only three scholarship guys coming back at that spot, in A.J. Logan, Terry Beckner, and Mark Hell. Utsi, Tyrell Jacobs, I guess you could call him maybe a defensive tackle D-end. He's been on the O-line a little bit. We just haven't seen much of him. But for all intents and purposes, you got three guys with any real level of experience coming back at D-tackle. So they needed to address that, and they did. I think some of those guys will be out there a lot, and maybe even in starting roles at times at the defensive tackle spot. Elsewhere, they did add length in the secondary. I think that was probably for the best. That was kind of a need that they said needed to be addressed, and I can see that. I think that's a fair assessment that they needed to get longer in the secondary. All five of their guys that are signed in the secondary are listed at 6 foot or taller. And they needed more bodies on the offensive line. I mean, the offensive line played pretty well last year, but there wasn't a lot of depth there. I mean, if they would have had one or two more injuries last year, they would have been in some real trouble. And they had all those departures in the offseason, combined with not a big group of signees on the offensive line in 2016. So they needed some more bodies there, and they signed five O-linemen. So in terms of that, yeah, I think they did check off the boxes that they really needed to.
In the last week, they lost two pretty high-profile wide receivers. They lose Jafar Armstrong from the Kansas City area. He goes to Notre Dame, and then they lose Elijah Gardner from Texas. He goes to Ohio State. So you're losing them to name brand programs. But did you feel like the loss of those two guys late in the process, maybe the fact they did not do well in the state of Missouri, only signing one player from the state of Missouri, which I can never remember happening, did that sort of define this class? Or in your opinion, did maybe some of these late defensive line JUCO signings save it?
I think you could look at it both ways, really. I think the late junior college signings saved the defensive side of the picture pretty well. I think, you know, better off to have those junior college guys than it would have been to add a couple more in-state signees. I think they really needed to add guys that could contribute immediately on the defensive line, and it seems like they've... Who knows how good these guys will be, but they put themselves in about as good a position as you could have, I think, going through the junior college route. So on that side, good. On the other side, I don't think we can just overlook the fact that they did lose two wide receivers who I think they were pretty excited about late in the process to bigger name programs. I mean, I know in talking to his high school coach and just getting a feel for the process, Missouri really was thinking it was going to have a steal in Elijah Gardner, a diamond in the rough that was being overlooked in Texas, perhaps because he hailed from a high school in a town of like 1,200 people. And, you know, I think sometimes it's harder for those guys to get discovered. But he was blazing quick, had great size, and he's like 6'4", and they beat Houston to get his commitment. So, you know, somebody else wanted him, but they weren't going up against Texas A&M and the likes. And then Ohio State came in late and stole him, and that's just kind of the way of the world in recruiting, and Missouri flipped some guys in the other direction, so that's just the way it goes. But I do think those kind of weakened the pool of talent at the skill positions that they were able to get. But I also, I mean, part of me thinks I'm crazy, but I look at this 5'8 guy, O'Shea Clark, that they got from Houston, and I know everybody looks good on a highlight film. Normally, I'm a cynic. I don't put much stock in this stuff, but I can't help but watch his highlight film and see him putting up 1,700 yards in the biggest classification of Texas football. And it wasn't like he was catching bubble screens and just scooting past everybody. I mean, he was catching bombs downfield time after time. So I kind of think that now they lost two in Armstrong and Gardner, and they got one. So you didn't cover your losses. But I do think they at least acquitted themselves well in scrambling and finding someone that maybe could be something for him. I mean, yeah, you look at his size, but really when he stands next to Jonathan Johnson, he's not going to look really any different. I mean, he is Jonathan Johnson's size. So that could be a guy that they dug up in the final stages that maybe kind of helped stem the tide of what they were losing there.
From talking to the coaches, the assistant coaches, and from what Barry Odom had to say, who did you get the sense that they're most excited about?
Well, I think they're excited about the junior college guys. I think they can step in and play. But moving past them, a couple guys that they feel like were kind of steals, and they're pretty excited about. One is Kobe Whiteside, a two-star defensive tackle from Houston. And in talking to Brick Haley, the new defensive line coach, and in talking to Damani Cross, they were rattling off his measurables. And, you know, if you're someone that puts a lot of stock in measurables, you're going to think this guy is going to be really good because he does have good measurables. And Brick Haley, I think, made a fair point of, you know, he's only listed at 6'1". If he's 6'3", this is a guy that probably gets a lot more offers. And I could see that line of thinking. And now he's not 6'3", so he's still got to get the job done at being a little bit shorter than what you're going to see from a lot of SEC defensive linemen. But we've seen that happen before, and so they think he's a guy, I think, that could really kind of anchor things down pretty well there and on the defensive line. And Cross seems to think that he's a guy that could play as a true freshman at defensive tackle. And then another guy that I think they feel like they did pretty well in stealing was Tyree Gillespie, two-star safety from Florida. They think he's a guy that's a lot better than that rating, a guy that somehow kind of flew under the radar from a lot of colleges, and they were able to snag a player that maybe is more valuable than what his rating says. And then the third guy I would say that they seem pretty excited about is Larry Roundtree, the running back from North Carolina, real north-south style runner. And Cornell Ford, you know, just the reactions about players that were the most excited was Damani Cross about Kobe Whiteside and Cornell Ford about Larry Roundtree. I mean, he could not say enough about Roundtree, and says he's already put his incumbent running backs on notice that they're going to be in for a battle. And I mean, you know, how much of that's hyperbole, who knows? But I do think for him to say that publicly is a sign that, at least in his eyes, this guy could step in and not necessarily unseat Demaria Crockett in week one by any means. But, you know, you're going to play three running backs, and maybe he's in there with Ish Witter and Nate Strong kind of fighting for a second or third string spot in year one. So those are the guys that I think really were coming off the tongue with a little bit more excitement on Wednesday.
I might add to it from Coach Glenn Ellerby, Case Cook, he was pretty excited about. He was a guy that they offered early, and then some high profile. I think Georgia and Florida both end up offering him, and he stuck with him. I don't think that's a kid. He's a center that is going to need to play anytime soon, obviously. But I think they're pretty high on him. I think a sneaky position of need might be linebacker, where they were just – I think they went through the players like kind of like water last year. Mm-hmm. And I think there's nobody that should feel great about their starting jobs coming into this season, the way the defense played last year. So they did sign a couple of linebackers that, you know, Jamal Brooks, Aubrey Miller, I think there's a potential for those guys to play too, and if not a linebacker, maybe on special teams.
Yeah, I agree. I think both those guys will play, and, you know, thinking back to Barry Odom's comments, he only mentioned one defensive guy by name during his press conference. He mentioned one defensive guy and I think one offensive guy by name. It wasn't really a slight to anybody else. Just as a head coach, you don't have time to tick through 25 guys. He talked about the quarterback, Taylor Powell, on the offensive side, and the one name to come off his lips on the defensive side was Aubrey Miller, the outside linebacker that they got from Memphis. Called him, I think, one of the most explosive players in the country, at least in Barry Odom's verbiage. So, yeah, him and Jamal Brooks, the middle linebacker, I agree, could, well, most likely will see the field on special teams and might be in contention for a spot on the two deep. And then probably also should mention Deron Davis, who's the highest rated player in this class, and that's probably one reason why I don't think to mention him is because I think maybe we all assume that if someone's going to get on the field in year one, he's a good candidate because of his rating. And Andy Hill thinks that he could be in the mix for time at outside receiver. Guy that played running back for much of his high school career, but they definitely see him as a receiver. He's the one in-state guy in the class, being from Lee's Summit North. He transferred from Hogan Prep, has a 4-star rating from some of the services. And, yeah, Andy Hill thinks that, yeah, I mean, you got Jamon Moore, you got Demetrius Mason coming back, and a couple other guys coming back there on the outside. But behind Moore and Mason, I think, you know, there's playing time to be had there on the two deep behind those two guys, and so he should be in the mix for that, I would think.
So according to the recruiting services, Missouri finishes about in the 40s, I think, if you were to average it out, and I think 13th in the SEC ahead of Vanderbilt. So, again, they're not wowing recruiting analysts. I think the coaches would probably tell you the same, that maybe the real big year for Missouri recruiting is going to be next year. It's the year there's a bumper crop of in-state talent, and Missouri needs to start getting some of it, or this is going to be a rough road, I think, for Barry Odom's crew. They haven't signed classes that blew anybody away his first 2 years, although when you look at some of the players they got last year that played as true freshman, Demarie Crockett far exceeded whatever his star rating was, and you could probably say the same for a few other guys.
Yeah, Demetrius Mason, yeah, for sure. He was a guy that really wasn't on anybody's radar until right before signing day. And actually, you know, sometimes I wonder about these words and hyperbole that coaches throw out on signing day, but to their credit, it was Ryan Walters was standing there on signing day last year telling everybody that would listen that Demetrius Mason's going to be the steal of this class, and that proved true. I mean, he was a guy at the 11th hour that they got that didn't have a very high rating and, you know, had over 500 yards receiving as a freshman.
You did a story a couple weeks ago on the proposed early signing period for football, which there currently is not one, and there could possibly become one in December. I thought there's a lot of layers to this, but I thought maybe just go over what your impressions were of whether you think that's a good idea. It seems like the coaches you talk to kind of see both sides of it and are not convinced it is.
Yeah, I talked to a few high school coaches. Some of them really liked it. Some of them were, as you said, much more lukewarm on it. Nobody I talked to, and Barry Odom is included in this, likes the idea of a summer early signing period, which was on the table for a while and has since been scrapped. That's not moving forward to a vote. The one that we're moving forward with and still needs to go up for a vote but sounds like it's going to be approved is an early signing period in mid-December. So basically 6-ish weeks before the regular signing period. Part of me says it's not that much earlier, so no need for everybody to get up in arms about it. But the other thing, I look at it two ways. One, I think it can be good for college coaches because there's a lot of these guys that have been committed for a long time that then the coaching staff still has to spend man hours and visits on going in December and January because you don't want the possibility of even your long committed guys flipping, and you could get some of those guys maybe to sign in December, and so you're not spending hours still recruiting a guy that you think you're going to have just to make sure in January, and you can apply those hours elsewhere and trying to round out your class. So in that way, I think it's good for colleges. The flip side, where I think maybe it could be not so good for colleges, is, you know, this is going to come right in the middle of bowl season, or in preparation for bowl season. And so if this, I don't know how popular that signing period is going to be, but if it's a period where like half your class signs, I could see that being a little bit stressful for coaches that are juggling bowl preparation and trying to lock up half their signing class. From the athlete perspective, I think it does make sense for certain guys, like, you know, Javon McQuitty from here locally in Columbia. He signed a financial aid agreement, enrolled at Nebraska, but wasn't able to sign a national letter of intent. You know, he's already enrolled. He's a student at Nebraska, but there was no early signing period for high school players. So he couldn't sign, at least not an NLI, which is the binding agreement. I do think that's kind of a shame for those high school players who know where they want to go, who want to enroll early, and they're left just signing a financial aid agreement, which guarantees their scholarship, so that's something, but it's not binding in the way that a national letter of intent is. And then also, like, for guys that just totally have their minds made up, I mean, I think about, like, Jamal Brooks. I talked to him for a story this week, and, like, he wasn't flipping his commitment. He knew he was coming to Missouri. They won him over, and his heart was set on coming there. He wasn't going to flip, so I could see him being a guy where that benefits. I think the biggest question is, does this change anything? Like, I think the real reason it's being proposed is maybe to try to cut down on some of these late commitment flips. I think that's, nobody's saying that from the college ranks, at least, because I don't think it looks great if they admit that they're passing initiatives to kind of protect their own frustrations. But I think that's the real reason why this is moving forward, is I think the coaches are tired of seeing commits flip and change their pledges in January. But is this really going to change that, or are they just going to change their pledges now in November? Or, I mean, they could still sign. Yeah, they could still sign in the second period and still change their pledges in January. But there are some good things. I mean, like, you think about that kid for Connecticut. I'm forgetting the name now, but the kid had been committed for a long time. There's a coaching change. He knows he wants to go to UConn. He could have signed, had there been an early period, he could have signed his NLI in December, locked everything in. Then there's a coaching change. His offer gets pulled, and he's kind of left up in the air, because the financial aid agreement is great if you're an early enrollee. Otherwise, you know, I don't think there's much incentive for the college just to send you a financial aid agreement. So for guys like that are committed early and want to protect their scholarship, guarantee it, and kind of shut down their recruitment, I can see the upside of having a December signing period.
And then the flip side of that is a kid signs with the school in December, that coach takes a different job,
yep,
or gets fired. Now you're stuck going to a school where you don't want to be going, or playing for a coach you don't want to play for. So maybe there needs to be a out for the players if that does happen, that if a coach leaves the school that you signed with, you're released from your agreement.
See, I would probably argue the opposite. I would say this is more a proof that you need to commit to the school and not to the coach.
That's good in theory, but
it is, and I don't think it happens. But I think that's naive for high school players to do, and maybe that should be expected from teenagers. But like I heard Barry Odom say on Wednesday, like, he wants his position coaches more involved in recruiting their guys because they're going to be coaching their guys. I think that's a smart move on his part. But if I'm a high school coach, I'm trying to do everything I can to get my high school athletes to commit on anything based on other than their position coach, because what are the chances that guy's going to be there when you're a junior and senior? I mean, these position coaches especially, they move around so much. I mean, Greg Brown is in and out before he can finish his bag of popcorn and on to his next school. Like, I mean, he's not going to be around, you know? So if people are committing and signing, especially based on position coaches, like, I think they do so at their own peril.
The other happening this week, they waited till after signing day when a lot of these staff changes happened. A lot of the hirings are announced. Missouri hires Brian Odom, the younger brother of Barry Odom, to be outside linebackers coach. So just your thoughts on that hire.
I guess it's going to raise some eyebrows. with Barry hiring his younger brother, in that Brian Odom's never been a position coach before. He's a guy that's worked in strength and performance at Houston, at Arizona, and then was a quality control coach on that staff at Washington State, but he wasn't like one of their nine assistants that was coaching a position. So in that way, I think it could raise some eyebrows. But the flip side of it is, and there will be a lot of people that disagree with this, but how critical are these position coaches in terms of what they're providing in coaching the position? Like, for example, like Glenn Ellerbe all of a sudden is a savant because Missouri's offensive line was pretty good in 2016. And, you know, if you ask Missouri fans, Jackie Shipp is, a lunkhead because the defensive line was no good in 2016. Well, what about Shipp in 2000 when Oklahoma won a national championship, you know? And you had Ryan Walters going from being a linchpin on the staff to a defense that was great in 2015 to being the co-defensive coordinator and safeties coach for a defense and safeties group that stunk in 2016. So, like, I guess what I'm saying is, how much impact do these position coaches really have on the group of guys that they're coaching anyway? To me, with these guys, you know, when you move past the coordinators, I think it's much more value in what they add as a recruiter. And, you know, it's really impossible to say how good Brian Odom would be as a recruiter. So, yeah, from the position coach side of it, I'm like, okay, you hired a former college running back who has no experience coaching linebackers to be your outside linebackers coach. On the flip side, I think if they think he can be a good recruiter, then okay, fine. It's a fine hire because I think that's as much a part of the job as anything else. And I'm not saying that anybody can be a position coach. I just think that, to use Damani Cross's words, it's more about the Jimmies and the Joes and the X's and the O's. And certainly I think at the position coach level, that's what you're seeing on the field is a reflection more of the talent that you have on the roster than whether the guy is a good position coach or not. So if he can recruit, then it's a fine hire. If he can't, then it's a hire that doesn't make much sense because he has no experience coaching outside linebackers. Really, my first reaction to this was twofold. One, does this mean they're changing to a 3-4? Because otherwise, Brian Odom is going to coach one man on the field, and that is a strong side linebacker. Because the weak side linebacker, I would think, would still fall under Damani Cross because he plays in the box. So even though if you're mapping out the positions on a field that looks like an outside linebacker, you know, the weak side linebacker plays in the box, so I would think Damani Cross is still going to coach the Mike and the Will, and that Brian Odom's, if they stayed in a 4-3, would just be responsible for the strong side backer. So, A, it makes me wonder if they're thinking about changing to a 3-4, in which case you would probably need an inside and outside linebacker coach. But then the other part of that is, why did you just sign five defensive tackles if you're changing to a 3-4? And then, or is Brian Odom going to be heavily involved in coaching special teams? That's the other thing I wonder, is this truly an outside linebacker / special teams coach position? Because I could see that making sense. He lettered at Oklahoma in 2001 on special teams. And, you know, outside linebackers, I mean, that kind of makes sense to double over into special teams. I wonder about those two things. Is this a precursor to a change to a 3-4, or is this perhaps a guy that's going to be doing more than just coaching strong side linebacker?
Yeah, because when we met with Barry Odom at Shakespeare's after the season, he'd mentioned that they were planning to move forward with the same defense they ran at the end of last year, which is a 4-3 attacking scheme. But then in that press release today announcing the hiring, he mentioned that the scheme they were going to run was similar to what Washington State ran, which they're more of a 3-4 team. So I think you add all that up, it does seem like they're probably more likely to go to a 3-4 scheme. And as far as the defensive tackles they signed, I guess when you play in a more of a 3-4 scheme, you're wanting bigger defensive ends. Of what, I mean, they're not just rush ends anymore, so I think some of those guys could probably do both. But yeah, that's the maybe the more interesting part of the hire, because, you know, who amongst us has any idea if Brian Odom is a good coach? You know, I think Pinkel caught a little heat from the nepotism angle when he had Alex Grinch hired, and then it turned out Alex Grinch is a pretty good coach. He goes to Washington State and whips their defense into shape in short order. So I kind of feel like, especially with a guy like Barry Odom, it's not like you're a legend around here and you're just throwing a bone to your little brother,
right?
And things will go on fine regardless. I mean, he's fighting for his life as a coach here, so I don't think he's going to make a hire that he doesn't think is going to help him out in a significant way, and that's far more important to him than whether his brother has a job as a position coach, because his brother already had a job at Washington State making
right,
doing fine. So I tend to give the benefit of the doubt on that angle of it to Barry Odom.
And if there's a spot on your staff where you can afford to do something like this with, I think it's this spot. I think it's totally reasonable to have Ryan Walters just take over coaching the secondary. You see that as at a lot of schools. I mean, some schools don't have a separate cornerbacks and safeties coach, so I think that's fine. And so then if you do that, then it frees you up to kind of be a little bit more creative with your last coaching position. And so, like I said, is his resume, when you look at it, you're going to see a lack of position coaching, but as you said, that doesn't mean he can't do the job. He maybe could, and I agree with you that I don't think this is just a nepotism hire. I think Barry Odom probably truly believes that Brian is going to be an asset to the staff, and maybe he will. I mean, he's worked in three Division I programs in Houston, Arizona, and Washington State. Now, not coaching a position, but in a he was basically the strength coach at two of those places, so it was a position of value.
And his brother played linebacker and is a defensive coordinator, basically,
right.
So it's not like information is that far away from him.
Yeah.
So that wraps up the football versions of the podcast for a while, at least until spring ball. So thank you again for joining the Mizzou Sports Podcast.